Okay, and for the main segment today, I'm joined by a very special guest, Angela Fernandez, who's a University of Toronto Faculty of Law professor and happens to have been my contracts prof in law school, but more importantly, these days is up to a number of really interesting things, including being an advisor with Animal Justice Canada. But more importantly, and what we're going to talk about today is Angela's new book, Pearson and Post, The Hunt for the Fox. It deals with law and professionalization in American legal culture. So for all the non-lawyers out there, or if you need a refresher on this case because it's been a while since you've been in law school, Pearson and Post is a really fascinating property law case that's frequently taught in Canadian and especially American law schools that deals with some interesting property concepts. And for me, it was actually probably the first animal law case that I studied in law school, to the extent that we can really call it animal law, because as we'll get into, it's really a lot more about possession and property, but the central sort of character and dispute in the case is a fox. So Angela, I want to get into the book in a minute, but first, why don't you just tell listeners a little bit about yourself and what you teach at U of T?
Yes, sure. Thanks so much, Camille, for doing this. So I teach, as Camille mentioned, contracts and also legal history. I do legal history seminars, and I'm a legal historian and cross-appointed in the history department at U of T. And so I got interested in Pearson and Post really from a history perspective, not even really as someone who teaches property. So I heard about it at a legal history conference a number of years ago now, and it just seemed to me that there was something about the case. It had almost like a fable-like quality about it. So basically the facts are there's a guy, he's hunting a fox with his dogs, and a second guy intervenes, he's called the saucy intruder in the case, and takes the fox.
Which one was Pearson and which one was Post?
So Post is the original pursuer.
Okay.
And Pearson is the saucy intruder.
Okay.
So it goes to a local jury trial. So the case is from 1802 in Southampton on Long Island. It goes to a jury trial, and the jury gives 75 cents to Post, the original pursuer. And that sort of should have been it. Like, it was, you know, a squabble between these two guys. Why they even bothered to go to their JP and do it. One of the chapters of the book talks about the fact that Post's family is sort of like up-and-coming wealth. And so he's putting on airs by, like, engaging in this sort of almost like an English style fox hunt. There's no horses, but mm-hmm. He's got dogs. And Pearson's family, they are farmers. Although he's a teacher, but that's the family interest, and all the land around where this chase happened is all Pearson land. And because of the farming interest, he's going to see the fox as vermin and as a pest, going to eat chickens. I think he's also maybe aware that if English-style fox hunting comes to this part of Long Island and it does bring horses, they'll be trampling of fields and fences and that sort of thing. So it's really like two clashing views of the fox. You know, the fox is an object of recreational sport versus, like, the fox is, like, an object of...
A pest.
Like, a pest, right. Basically.
Well, and the judgment is so interesting in the case. I mean, we'll talk about not the jury trial, but the eventual judgment when it goes up to a higher court. But, I mean, the fox is referred to repeatedly as, like, basically the enemy of mankind and all these really derogatory terms.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Fox is hated.
Yeah, absolutely.
By one judge,
absolutely.
At least.
Yeah, absolutely. And that sort of seems to go without saying. It certainly goes without saying that, you know, one of these two individuals is going to be declared the owner of the fox. And there's no sense at all that, like, well, maybe the fox isn't owned by anyone, or maybe, you know, he or she kind of owns themselves the way, you know, we sort of think about ourselves that way.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. And if students are going to encounter it, they're going to encounter it in a property classroom. So it's already all presupposed that...
Everyone assumes the fox is somebody's property.
Exactly.
We just have to decide who's.
We just have to decide as between these two people, you know?
Yeah.
And in fact, I was working on this case for a very long time before I ever thought there was anything wrong with that either.
Mm.
And it was actually one time when I was lecturing on the case. I was pretty deep into it at that point. It was in a colleague's property class, Lisa Austin, who also teaches at U of T. And there was a student in the room who put their hand up and said, but they're both going to kill it, right? And I was like, yeah, I mean, you know, one guy wanted the dogs to rip it up, and the other guy, he didn't shoot it, but he clubs it with a piece of fence railing. And I think that was really the start of me thinking, oh yeah, you know, this is a problem. And it's not normally going to be raised or talked about it, you know, unless there is a student who, and, you know, would be a pretty brave person who would put their hand up and kind of go, well, maybe this shouldn't be property at all in the property class, you know?
Yeah, no law student wants to say that in the first year of property law class, because animals are obviously considered property.
Yeah, exactly. But I suspect that, you know, this case has been taught for 200 years, you know, every fall in an American classrooms, you know, in the U.S. for sure, and to Canada, in Canada too, to a pretty great, good extent too. There's probably always people there who are having that thought and who are having that feeling, but who, you know, are not brave enough to put their hand up and do any questioning of that.
Oh, I was probably one of them in first year property who I had Lisa Austin, who you just mentioned,
as
my professor.
Yeah,
I don't think you guest lectured on it, but
because I probably wasn't deep enough into it at that point.
No, it definitely occurred to me that it's a fundamental issue that's messed up in this case, is how the fox's interests just aren't on the table, or aren't on the table in the judgment, which you can kind of understand because it's 200 years ago, but not on the table even in the way that the case is taught.
In our contemporary, exactly.
So why don't you just explain what got you interested in doing all this research and what the process was like? Because, you know, I've got the book here in front of me, and it's, how many pages? 360-some pages of, like, pretty intense legal research. You went to the archives in New York. You dug up all this stuff that nobody had ever seen before. What motivated you to do that?
Well, I mean, really, one of the areas that I've been exploring, and actually, it goes all the way back to when I was in law school. The first paper I ever wrote in law school was about this kind of thing. It's called legal archaeology, and basically the idea is you focus on a case, often a famous case, like a chestnut case or something that's really central to the canon, taught in the classrooms frequently, and you dig around and try to find more information about it. So either the litigants or where it happened or the judges who decide on it. And there's a legal historian named Brian Simpson who was really the person who founded this field kind of like in the 1980s and 1990s. So when I went to law school, I guess it was like 1996, I learned about his work through my contracts professor, actually, who was a legal historian.
Oh.
And we were, we got assigned this task, which was to pick a case from one of our classes and write a paper about it. So I picked a case that Brian Simpson had done one of these studies on, and I just, you know, kind of like summarized what was happening. But that was my introduction to that type of legal historical research. And I was like, oh, this is really fun, actually, because these are cases that, you know, people know and you can talk about. And, you know, it's sort of one of those things, like if you're at a cocktail party and you start talking to another person who's gone to law school or who's a lawyer, and you just say the name of a case, like you say, I don't know, Hadley and Baxendale or something, and you both know, oh, you're going to have a conversation now about remoteness. that's just Hadley and Baxendale just means remoteness, you know?
Yeah, so just one of the leading cases on a particular doctrine.
Yeah, so I thought, oh, this is this kind of weird, quirky thing about lawyers and law and the way that it's produced and reproduced over time, that we use the cases in this kind of way. And I thought, I would maybe to do this. And I did, at one point, do it on a rather obscure case. That, you know, it was kind of interesting and whatever, but I thought, you know what, I think you really have to do it with a case that's more well known.
I guess if you want people to actually read and appreciate your work, that helps.
Exactly. And they care about it, and then they want to, you know, learn more about it, right? So that's sort of where it started. And Pearson was one that people had tried to do lots of stuff on. When I first learned about it, it was at a legal history conference when I was first started teaching. I think it was in my second or maybe my third year of teaching. And I almost got the feeling that it had been like made up or something. Like I felt like I wasn't sure it had actually happened. And the reason why I thought this was that the appellate decision, which is, so after the jury trial, it ended up going to the New York Supreme Court, and the lawyers really like bring in all these old learned authorities about how do you establish possession in a wild animal, because it's such kind of chestnut problem that goes way back. And they really kind of puff it up and blow it out of proportion for 75 cent.
Lawyers like to do that.
And lawyers definitely like to do it. So it's sort of like, and that's why the picture is like the eagle, like grabbing the fox and making off of it, because it's sort of about the way that professionalization just kind of cashed in on this dispute.
People's problems.
And then kind of like hijacks it.
Well, and for all you listeners out there who are wondering what the eagle is, well, I'll post a link to the book, obviously, in the show notes, and you can see the cover of it is this enormous sort of black eagle carrying off a poor little fox.
Yeah, and you'd think actually that that fox is done for, but the storybook that I found it in, this book series called Forgotten Books, which he actually survives that incident.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Glad for the fox.
Yeah, it's good. But so there had been this appellate decision, but there was no record of the lower court level.
And just backing up for a sec, what was the appellate decision, just so our listeners sort of understand what the ultimate result was?
The ultimate result, yes. So basically what happened in the appellate decision was they reversed the finding of the jury, and they said that the person who had established best possession or occupation of the animal was the intruder, was Pearson. And Pearson was the one who had appealed because he had lost at the earlier level.
At the jury.
Exactly. And so the majority decision held... it had held for Pearson, and that ended up being interpreted in the common law as a precedent for what they call the capture rule. And it's this idea that it's better to have the property ownership follow the most sort of secure or complete act.
Right.
So what was wrong with what Post was doing was that he was just pursuing. He hadn't actually completed the pursuit, and so the fox might get away.
Right.
So the cleaner, and over time that came to be, especially when law and economics kind of got a hold of the case in the 80s, they really turned it into a kind of classic example of bright line rules versus fuzzy standards. And that is kind of the standard way in which the case is understood, especially in the US, mm-hmm. is in this very really pared down, instrumental sort of way. Capture rule is better. Capture rule is clearer. I kind of came to this feeling like, well, I don't know, capture rule, you're pursuing and it's reasonable pursuit. And it turned out once I looked into it, there were actually lots of other authorities on the other side, including some Canadian cases on the other side.
Okay.
And so when I first used to talk about this at American conferences, people would be like, well, obviously the capture rule is the better rule. And I'd be like, well, no, that's actually not obvious. And, it's just because you've received it a certain way that you see it a certain way. And that's what sort of got me onto the path of saying, it is this very known and familiar kind of legal artifact, but could we see it differently? Could we redescribe it and re-understand it and really kind of ultimately perhaps from an animal perspective, re-employ it to, shift a conversation about the animal as object to a conversation about the animal as subject.
Right. And bringing the animal's interest into the case.
And that's sort of what started to happen to me as I was writing it. It was a pretty gradual thing, but, I was working on it for over 10 years. So, at a certain point, I felt like I couldn't ignore that. And the professionalization that I was tracing, the way that the lawyers got a hold of it, that's... sort of the first half of the book is the original local context. The second half is how, legal academics got a hold of it and brought it into the treatises, and then from the treatises into the case books, and then into the classrooms. And, that's really like a kind of over 200-year history. Mm. And so it seemed to me that everybody was basically profiting from the death of this animal in one way or another. And I was feeling like, I am too. Like, here I am. Right. I'm still making hay with it. And it started to bother me, especially after I was having experiences like what happened with a student in Lisa's class. I was like, yeah, you know what? She's right. And I have to figure out how to bring that perspective in to some extent. And the timing was kind of serendipitous, but I happened to meet a woman who was teaching in the history department who was working on a book on pet keeping in 19th century Britain. Hmm. We were at a women's conference, a legal history planning conference together. And I said, oh my God, that's so funny. I'm working on a fox hunting case from early 19th century New York. And she's like, wow, really? And I was like, oh, we should have lunch and we should, talk about our projects. And anyway, so that's what we did. And we ended up finding out that the Jagmeet Humanities Institute had this little pot of money that they would give to people who would set up interdisciplinary groups at U of T working in different departments. And I was like, this is Sarah Amato. And I was like, okay, well, Sarah's in history, I'm in law. Let's find people who are working on projects that have something to do with animals. And so we started when the working group started.
All right. So the working group, any listeners who have not been to the working group or aware of it, for, I don't know, since what, 2013, 2014?
Something like that. Probably 5 years.
It's been a really, really exciting and stimulating way for academics and lawyers and other people just to get together in Toronto at a facility hosted by U of T, this is the Jackman Humanities Institute, and talk about works in progress people are working on, talk about court cases. I went and spoke about the court case that Peter and I did, the Supreme Court case at one point.
Oh, the bestiality,
and, yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. And there's just been tons of interesting academics come in there through the years. So what's so interesting to me, Angela, is how this book really got you down that path, and it was considering the Fox in this particular case, who died over 200 years ago, that kind of brought you over to, you know, being more interested academically and personally in animal issues.
Yeah, exactly. And it was a very much a sideways movement, and it was very much a, like, an unpredictable thing. It's not like you would have thought, oh, well, this is what's going to happen. It really, you know.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I went to law school to be an animal rights lawyer. A lot of people do that these days, and you just kind of came into it through this other project.
Yeah. You know, and I had to learn so much about fox hunting, and I had to, I really got into that whole... you know, all that literature. And I just thought, you know, something is not sitting right with me. And, you know, an aspect of the case, which we haven't talked about yet, is the way that the dissent is written in this jocular, witty kind of way.
So the majority says that first possession is the rule. Whoever captures the fox first gets the fox. And the dissenting judge, what was his name?
Brockhulst Livingston.
What a name, Brockhulst.
Brockhulst. Yeah, Brockhulst.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't think anyone names their kids Brockhulst anymore.
Sorry if there's any Brockhulst out there. It's a great name. So the dissent.
Yeah, so it's written, in this very jocular tone, which I actually think is part of the reason why the case has kind of stayed around all this time. It's had such staying power, is because it's a great read.
It's entertaining.
It's very entertaining, and to teach it, and to, you know, it's fun.
And what does he say in his dissent? What is his issue with the majority's reasons?
Well, you know, it's very convoluted, but he's basically trying to say, you know, reasonable pursuit. It's also called hot pursuit, that should be enough. And the majority says it's impolite, but it's not illegal. Mm. He's basically saying, no, it should be enough to establish that you've got a secure enough hold. And there's things in the dissent that don't make a lot of sense. And,
yeah, it seems like he's just kind of tooting his own horn.
Well, that's it. And the original person who I saw presenting on this, her name's Andrea McDowell. She was talking about the dissent, and she was trying to kind of make sense of it and figure it out. And I think it was actually reading her work and talking to her about it that I sort of came to the conclusion that that was a futile endeavor. Hmm. That was not what was going on here. It was not your typical rational, logical, legal analysis. The guy was basically just having a good time.
He's just enjoying writing a ridiculous decision.
Exactly. And, you know, and in the book, I talk a little bit about the way that, you know, law reports were not regularly published in those days. So there is a chance that when he wrote that, he actually didn't mean it to be for public circulation, that it could have been kind of like a lawyerly camaraderie.
Inside joke.
Yes, exactly. And one of the chapters is actually about this thing that lawyers have done as far probably back as there's been lawyers, which is engage in these, sometimes they're called courts of Dover. They're basically like fraternal clubs where mooting of legal problems goes on. Hmm. And so I think there's, you know, a very real sense in which those lawyers, and they were up and coming.
So the counsel who represented lawyers, Pearson and Post?
Exactly. That they, especially Pearson's lawyer, who's responsible for the appeal, that they were, you know, almost doing that kind of play, like that lawyerly play, almost like what we do with moot courts now.
Right.
You get a problem, you know, both sides go at it, and then, you know, there's a kind of a game kind of feel to it. So in the book, I call this legal solemn foolery, and I have a whole chapter where I trace other instances of it. What I noticed once I started to kind of follow this thread was that it seemed to me that this was often happening with animals.
Mm-hmm.
That because I think it was just, you know, animals, we assume they're, you know, legally, morally, economically insignificant, and especially, you know, this fox, 75 cents. Well, you know, they don't matter, and so it's okay to have fun and to make light and, you know, and still, I think, to you know, kind of laugh when we're talking about this.
Oh, it happens still today. I mean, the example that comes to my mind most prominently, which I'm sort of glad to have an entree point into that issue because it relates to the book and to the Pearson and Post case, is the IKEA monkey. Remember how hilarious people found that when there was this poor monkey wandering around by himself in an IKEA parking lot?
Yeah, and similarly, like if he hadn't been wearing that little shearling coat, you know, we probably, you know, wouldn't have heard as much about him.
Right, yeah, that's right. The coat really made it. And then, like, I get it. It was like, what the heck is going on? It's kind of, you know, entertaining and really out there. But really divorced from the context of what the monkey's going through.
Exactly.
How terrified he must be to be in the winter by himself in a parking lot without knowing anyone and then wandering into IKEA. But the reason I'm glad to have a chance to bring up the IKEA monkey case is because I see it as a case where this sort of first possession, not so much the first possession rule, but the idea that capturing an animal that's wild by nature entitles you to possession of that animal, and that once that animal is released back into the wild, the animal's fair game again for someone else to come along.
Capture, yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Which is, there was a court case involving the IKEA monkey, who had been sent to a sanctuary after Toronto Animal Services seized the monkey because he was not supposed to be kept in the city of Toronto. And his former owner, who now has a private menagerie with many, many monkeys, she sued to get him back. And what happened in that case is the court essentially said that because he had escaped, he was no longer her property. He reverted to not being her property the second that he was, again, wilded back to nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
And whoever captured him at that point had possession and ownership.
Right. Yes. Yes. And you know, in reading that case, in fact, in one of the working group sessions, we read it, and the non-lawyer people in the group, which is, that was so it's so good about the group, right? Because you have these lawyer people who are seeing things, you know, the way we're trained to see them, and then you have other people who are like, "What?"
It really broadens everyone's perspective.
Exactly. And one of the people, you know, she was like, "Are all legal judgments written like this?" Because that judgment is so convoluted. I mean, my take on it is that I think that the judge was basically trying to do the right thing, which was, you know, have Darwin be a place where it was appropriate monkey place for him to be. But, you know, she didn't want to use, like, the best interests of the animal because that would be
too revolutionary.
Exactly. Too person-y and not, you know, too much like person and not enough like property. So she did the wild animal analysis. But, I mean, really, like, you know, for a domesticated animal that's owned, do you even characterize him as a wild animal? I mean, just seems like that doesn't make a lot of sense. And is he wild to the Scarborough parking lot? No, he's not in his indigenous context, right? Like, or his, you know. And I think actually somebody else has written about this in the Peter and Katie and Vaughn's book, and sort of saying the same thing. Like, really, it should be.
Right, and there's a chapter in it's the Canadian Perspectives on Animals and the Law, edited by my co-host Peter Zankoff with Katie Sykes and Vaughn Black, and we'll post a link to that in the show notes too in case you want to order it.
Yes, that's a great idea. Yeah, so I think that wild domestic distinction, it gets used sort of instrumentally like that, sometimes in weird ways to achieve results that you think if it, you know, we could, you know, are we moving toward a point where it wouldn't be like so unthinkable to say, oh, well, actually, this is more of a personhood, like, not like a human being, but a personhood, if as terms of the legal analysis goes, you know, we should be using that lens as opposed to the property lens.
Well, and this is a good segue into some of your other work, because you've been working on personhood versus property issues and analyzing some of the constructs that go into that. Why don't you just fill us in a little bit on that? I know you spoke about this and presented the paper at Oxford Summer School this summer, where I was as well.
Yeah. So that work is basically, what I'm trying to do there is say, I don't think that either property or personhood really is capturing or characterizing, you know, what we're talking about when we're talking about non-human animals. And so maybe we should be using an idea of quasi-property or quasi-personhood to sort of at least embed in the term that, the you know, we're acknowledging this is not, sentient property is not like other types of property. And, you know, we might not yet be at the point where people are feeling comfortable and okay enough with using personhood, even though, you know, Steve Wise's work shows, you know, you're not trying to say these non-human animals are the same as human beings. When people hear person, they think you mean human being. So that's
totally,
that's very difficult.
It's a barrier.
It really is. And so you know, what I'm suggesting is something that I don't think, you know, is the permanent place where we should be in this, but maybe as a kind of a temporary heuristic to, or bridging the gap kind of a concept, to think of it in quasi terms, because I actually think it does describe where we are currently at in terms of the law. You know, there's all this stuff about you know, for pets, that they're not like the rest of property.
They're not like the dinner plates when you're getting a divorce and pet custody issues arrive. They're not like
exactly
the couch.
And sentience has made so much headway in different jurisdictions and different pieces of legislation and documents and cases. And so I feel like that idea, you know, of sentient property being different than property, that's pretty there. And then WISE is working on the personhood stuff from the other end. So I think we're getting there, but I think there's still these like real conceptual barriers. Mm-hmm. And I think the language that we use matters. I mean, people who are more abolitionist, they think we'll just stop using property language altogether. And, you know, maybe that will eventually come. But my feeling is that in the interim, we need something that at least accurately characterizes what we're currently doing.
It would be better to have a better way of conceptualizing it. I've always thought that the idea that property can't have standing, which is essentially what personhood hopes to accomplish, is, I don't really think, supported by the way that we consider property right now. I mean, corporations are the property of human beings, yet they do have standing to go to court. And there's some middle ground in some way that animals maybe could retain some sort of property status, but still have a bundle of rights. And property is essentially a bundle of rights in relation to some item.
Yeah, exactly. So, and, you know, there is already, like, if there are any rights, and there are, because there's anti-cruelty statutes, then there is a, you know, there's a capacity to bear rights. And so that's some kind of legal personhood, you know, and it's not, you know, obviously this is terrible and it's not good enough, but that's actually already there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I sort of think that our language should be acknowledging that, you know, and not conceding, oh, well, you know, things either have to be property or they have to be persons.
Yeah, totally.
Totally. And that binary. It's too binary. It's a trap, the binary, I think.
It is. Yeah, I mean, and for any listeners out there who are curious about this, you know, animals benefit from a lot of legal protections right now. So there's statutes that say, with respect to certain animals at least, that they must be provided with adequate food and water, adequate shelter, veterinary care if they require it. And you could sort of say those are like small R rights, like in the sense that entitles an animal to a specific thing and specific treatment. But the reason they don't really rise to the level of what I would say are capital R rights is that they have no enforcement mechanism. An animal can't go to court themselves and seek a remedy if they're not being provided with water. The owner, the human, could be prosecuted, but that's a different thing from the animal enforcing their rights. So when you think of that conceptually, it's not really a large jump.
It's not a huge leap.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
You just need an animal to get into court and have standing to enforce those rights, and that breaks down that barrier.
Yeah, and they're an entity capable of, you know, bearing interests. And so, you know, that's it. Like, that's kind of all you need.
Yeah, the law already accepts that they have interests.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Angela, so much for this interesting, enlightening conversation.
Yeah, thanks for suggesting it, and it was very fun doing it.
It was a pleasure. Hope to have you back again soon.
Absolutely, anytime.